My topic for today, as you can see, is objections so bad I couldn't have made them up. Or the world's 10 worst objections to the Kalam cosmological argument. I have been publishing on the Kalam cosmological argument for over 30 years now. And I have tried to be very forthcoming in responding to critics of the argument. I've always tried to anticipate and then respond adequately to objections to the arguments that might be raised. And I figured that I had dealt with virtually all of the objections that might be raised against the argument, and then any further debate would simply concern the adequacy of my responses. Alas, however, I have discovered that I have been unsuccessful in covering all of the bases. For what I've come to realize is that some objections are so squirrely, so off the wall, so bad that I could never have anticipated them. Now, these arguments are not to be found in scholarly publications. Rather, these are to be found on the internet and featured in YouTube videos. Up until now, I've simply focused on scholarly critiques of the Kalam cosmological argument because I figured that such popular criticisms were so misguided or simply repetitive of scholarly work that there was no necessity to respond to them. But now I've chosen instead to respond directly to the worst of these objections. Now, some of you might be thinking at this point, well, if these objections are really that bad, then why waste time responding to them? Well, I think there are several reasons for doing so. First of all, these objections are very widespread and very influential. Infidel websites and YouTube videos are replete with these criticisms. They reach thousands of people, and they are confidently touted by many as being decisive refutations of the argument. Secondly, the average layman, not being trained in logic and philosophy, may find himself at a loss as to how to answer these objections. I frequently get emails at our website, reasonablefaith.org, from people who have seen one of these videos or one of these websites and are asking for help in knowing how to respond. They're unable to discern often where the fallacies lie, and so they find themselves at a loss for words in confronting these objections in conversation with unbelievers, and they may even find some of these criticisms to be quite powerful themselves. Finally, number three, I think that responding to these objections does yield some positive insight, which is valuable. For example, we can come to clarify and so come to a better understanding of certain fallacies which are lodged against the argument. And we can gain a deeper understanding into certain key concepts that play a role in the argument. So I think taking the time to answer these objections will yield definite positive benefits and prove to be time well spent. Now, I had initially thought to arrange our world's 10 worst objections in a sort of top 10 list, culminating in the worst of the worst. But unfortunately, the worst of the worst is not necessarily the most entertaining, and therefore such a list might be something of an anticlimax. So rather than rank the objections in this way, I've decided instead to arrange them according to the premises of the argument, grouping together first objections to the general form of the argument, followed by objections to the first premise of the argument, then objections to the second premise, and finally wrapping up with objections to the argument's conclusion. So, for those who are as yet unfamiliar with the Kalam cosmological argument, let me give a brief summary of it. It is a very simple syllogism. Premise one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Two, the universe began to exist Three, therefore, the universe has a cause. Now, the second crucial premise is supported by both philosophical arguments against the infinitude of the past, as well as by scientific arguments for a beginning of the universe. And having then arrived at the conclusion that the universe has a cause, one can do a conceptual analysis of what it is to be a cause of the universe and deduce what properties such a being may have. One is thereby led to conclude that there exists an uncaused, beginningless, changeless, timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful, personal creator of the universe. And for the intriguing details about this argument, you can look at my book On Guard or Reasonable Faith. So, with this summary of the argument in hand, let's go to the first set of objections to the form of the argument. The first objection goes like this. Craig says that he believes in God on the basis of the self-authenticating witness of the Holy Spirit in his heart, not on the basis of the Kalam cosmological argument. In fact, he says that even if the argument were refuted, he would still believe in God. This is blatant hypocrisy on Craig's part. Response to premise one. Let me see if I have a power. No, we don't have a PowerPoint for the response. Okay, my response to this. The problem with this objection is that even if I were a hypocrite, there's just no relationship between the soundness of an argument and the psychological state of the person propounding it. The objector is guilty of putting forth a textbook example of argument ad hominem. That is to say, the fallacy of trying to invalidate a position by attacking the character of the person who defends it. So, this raises the question, well, what does make then for a sound deductive argument? Well, the answer is true premises and valid logic. An argument is sound if the premises of the argument are true and the conclusion follows from the premises by the rules of logic. And the soundness of the Kalam cosmological argument is thus entirely independent of me. The argument was, after all, defended by people like the medieval Muslim theologian Al-Ghazali in the 12th century, 1,000 years before I was born. If the argument is sound, it was sound then. If it's sound, it was sound during the Jurassic Age, when no human beings were about and nobody had propounded it. So my alleged hypocrisy simply has nothing to do with the soundness of the argument. Now, to be a good argument, an argument must admittedly be more than merely sound. If the premises of an argument are true, but we have no evidence for the truth of those premises, then the argument will not be a good one. It may, unbeknownst to us, be sound, but in the absence of any evidence for the premises, it won't, or at least it shouldn't, convince anyone. The premises have to have some kind of epistemic warrant for us in order for a sound argument to be a good argument. And I've argued that what is needed is that the premises should not only be true, but they should be more plausible in light of the evidence than their opposites or their negations. If a premise is more plausibly true in light of the evidence than its negation, then we should believe the premise rather than its negation. Now, plausibility is to a certain extent person relative. Some persons may find a premise plausible, and other persons may not find it plausible. And in that sense, the goodness of an argument is not entirely independent of people's psychological states. But in the case of the Kalam cosmological argument, I do find the premises more plausibly true than not, and therefore I'm convinced that it is a good argument. I just don't regard the argument as the basis for my belief in God. And I've been very candid about that. My belief in God is a properly basic belief grounded in the inner witness of God's Holy Spirit. And I find it odd that rather than being commended for my candor about this, I'm condemned instead for hypocrisy. Now, I elsewhere defended the proper basicality of belief in God on the basis of the Spirit's witness. But that's unnecessary to do this morning. Even if I were entirely mistaken about that, it would have no bearing on the worth of the Kalam cosmological argument. To illustrate, suppose I believe that Abraham Lincoln was one of the greatest of the American presidents. And in order to convince you of this, I present to you the testimony of expert historians, along with a detailed account of Lincoln's amazing accomplishments. But suppose that the real reason that I believe that Lincoln was so great was because he had a beard. And having once had a beard myself, I am prejudiced in favor of bearded presidents. Well, obviously, my personal prejudice in this regard would have no bearing whatsoever on the worth of the historical evidence that I have presented to you for Lincoln's greatness. Similarly, whatever reasons I might have personally for believing in God, whether it's the witness of the Holy Spirit or the ontological argument or divine revelation or whatever, that just has no relation to the value of the Kalam cosmological argument. The skeptic might not like my taking belief in God as properly basic, but that's not a criticism of the Kalam cosmological argument. That is, at most, a rejection of the proper basicality of belief in God, but that has no bearing on the value of the Kalam argument. Objection number two. The Kalam cosmological argument is question-begging. For the truth of the first premise presupposes the truth of the conclusion. And therefore, the argument is an example of reasoning in a circle. Response to objection two. All that the objector has done is to describe the nature of a deductive argument. In a deductive argument, the conclusion is implicit in the premises, simply waiting to be derived by the rules of logical inference. A classical illustration of a deductive argument is the following. 1. All men are mortal. 2. Socrates is a man. 3. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. This argument has the same form as the Kalam cosmological argument. And the rule of inference, which allows you to derive this conclusion, even has a name. It's called modus ponens. P implies Q, P, therefore, Q. This is one of the most basic rules of logical inference. And yet, incredibly, I have even seen claims by internet critics that this argument concerning Socrates is also a question-begging argument. Now, this raises the question of what it means for an argument to be question-begging. Technically, arguments don't beg the question. People beg the question. One is guilty of begging the question if one's only reason for accepting a premise is that one already believes in the conclusion. For example, suppose you were to present the following argument for the existence of God. 1. Either God exists or the moon is made of green cheese. 2. The moon is not made of green cheese. Therefore, 3. God exists. Now, this is a sound argument for God's existence. Its premises are both true, and the conclusion follows from the premises by the logical rules of inference. In this case, the rule of inference is called disjunctive syllogism. Nevertheless, this argument isn't any good because the only reason for believing the first premise is that you already believe that God exists. A disjunction is true if one of the disjuncts is true. But that's the argument's conclusion. And therefore, in putting forth this argument, you're reasoning in a circle or begging the question. The only reason that you believe one is that you already believe three. Now, neither the argument for Socrates' mortality nor the Kalam argument is like this. In each case, reasons are given for believing the first premise, which are quite independent of the argument's conclusion. Biological and medical evidence can be marshaled on behalf of the premise that all men are mortal. And I've presented arguments, which I'll share in a moment, for the truth of the premise that everything that begins to exist has a cause. And therefore, I've not begged the question. The objector has made the elementary mistake of confusing a deductive argument with a question-begging argument. Objection number three. The argument commits the fallacy of equivocation. In the first premise, the word cause means material cause, while in the conclusion, it does not. Response to objection three. This objection raises the question of what it is to commit the fallacy of equivocation. This fallacy is using a word in the same context to mean two different things. For example, suppose someone were to argue, one, Socrates was Greek. Two, Greek is a language. Three, therefore, Socrates is a language. Such an argument would commit the fallacy of equivocation, using the word Greek in one premise to denote an ethnicity or nationality, and then later to denote a language. So this would be an example of the fallacy of equivocation. Now, in formulating the Kalam cosmological argument, I intended to speak of what Aristotle called efficient causes. Aristotle distinguished between efficient causes and material causes. An efficient cause is what produces the effect in being, while a material cause is the stuff out of which a thing is made. For example, Michelangelo was the efficient cause of the statue David, and the material cause of the David was the marble block out of which it was sculpted. And my claim that whatever begins to exist has an efficient cause, and therefore the universe, having begun to exist, must have an efficient cause. The fallacy of equivocation immediately evaporates. Now, these first three objections to the Kalam cosmological argument, while not very scintillating, are among the very worst objections to the argument. Without challenging the truth of either premise, they attack what is a logically impeccable argument. So let's go on to objections to the first premise. Objection number four. The first premise is based upon the fallacy of composition. It fallaciously infers that because everything in the universe has a cause, therefore the whole universe has a cause. Response to number four. In order to understand this objection, we need to understand the fallacy of composition. This is the fallacy of reasoning that because every part of a thing has a certain property, therefore the whole thing has that same property. Now, while wholes do sometimes possess the properties of their parts, for example, a fence, every plank of which is green, is also green, this isn't always the case. For example, every little part of an elephant might be light in weight, but that doesn't imply that the whole elephant is light in weight. Now, I have never argued that because every part of the universe has a cause, therefore the whole universe has a cause. That would be manifestly fallacious. Rather, the reasons that I've offered for thinking that everything that begins to exist has a cause are as follows. One, something cannot come from nothing. To claim that something can come into being out of nothing is literally worse than magic. When a magician pulls a rabbit out of the hat, at least you've got the hat, not to mention the magician. But if you deny premise one, you've got to think that the whole universe just popped into being at some point in the past for no reason whatsoever. But nobody sincerely believes that things, say a horse or an Eskimo village, can just pop into existence uncaused from nothing. Secondly, if something can come into being from nothing, then it becomes inexplicable why just anything and everything doesn't come into being from nothing. Think about it. Why doesn't Beethoven or bicycles or beer just pop into existence, pardon me, uncaused from nothing? Why is it only universes which can come into being from nothing? What makes nothingness so discriminatory? There can't be anything about nothingness that would favor universe because nothingness is not anything, and therefore it has no properties, no potentialities. There isn't anything to be constrained. Number three, common experience and scientific evidence support the truth of premise one. Premise one is constantly verified and never falsified. So it's hard to understand how the atheist who is a scientific naturalist could deny that premise one is more plausibly true in light of the evidence than not. Now, note well that this third reason is an appeal to inductive reasoning, not reasoning by composition. It's drawing an inductive inference about all the members of a class based upon a sample of the class. Inductive reasoning underlies all of science and is not to be confused with reasoning by composition. So, this objection is aimed at a straw man of the objector's own construction. Objection number five. If the universe began to exist, then it must have come from nothing. But that's quite plausible, since there are no constraints on nothing, and so nothing can do anything, including producing the universe. Response to objection five. The objector seems to be hopelessly confused about the use of the word nothing. The word nothing is simply a term of universal negation. It means not anything. When it is rightly said that nothing preceded the universe, we don't mean that something preceded it and it was nothing. Rather, we mean it was not preceded by anything. Reifying negative terms has been the butt of jokes as old as Homer's story of the Cyclops and Odysseus. Just imagine the following dialogue between two people discussing the course of the Second World War. Nothing stopped the German advance from sweeping over Belgium. Oh, that's good. I'm glad they were stopped. But they weren't stopped. But you said nothing stopped them. Well, that's right. Well, then they were stopped. No, nothing stopped them. Well, that's what I said. They were stopped, and it was nothing which stopped them. No, I mean they weren't stopped by anything. Oh, well, why didn't you say so in the first place? Here, the objector, in thinking that nothing produced the universe, is similarly guilty of the same mistake. Nothingness isn't anything, and therefore it has no properties, no powers. And therefore, it is wholly misconceived to say that nothing produced the universe. We mean, rather, the universe was not produced by anything. To say the universe was caused by nothing is to say that the universe had no cause. It wasn't caused by anything. And that is simply metaphysically absurd. Out of nothing, nothing comes. This is a metaphysical principle as old as Plato. Look at what Plato says in the Timaeus. He says, "We must, in my opinion, begin by distinguishing between that which always is and never becomes from that which is always becoming and never is. Everything that becomes or changes must do so owing to some cause, for nothing can come to be without a cause. As for the world, call it that, or cosmos, or any other name acceptable to it, we must ask about it the question one is bound to ask about anything, whether it has always existed and had no beginning, or whether it has come into existence and started from some beginning. The answer is that it has come into being, and what comes into being or changes must do so, we said, owing to some cause." As Plato's statement indicates, the causal principle, which is the first premise of the cosmological argument, is one of the oldest and most widely recognized principles of metaphysics. Objections to the second premise. Objection number 6. Nothing ever begins to exist. For the material of which something consists precedes it. So it is not true that the universe began to exist. Response to number 6. This is my favorite bad objection, since the assertion that nothing ever begins to exist is so patently ridiculous. Did I exist before I was conceived? If so, where was I? What was I doing during the Jurassic period? Has the Empire State Building always existed? If so, why didn't the Native Americans ever notice it there on the island of Manhattan? This objection obviously confuses a thing with the matter or the stuff of which the thing is made. Just because the stuff of which something is made has always existed doesn't imply that the thing itself has always existed. Now, the objector might save himself from the embarrassment of saying that he has always existed by adopting a viewpoint called muriological nihilism. Muriological nihilism. This is the doctrine that there are no composite objects. All that exists is the fundamental particles, which can be arranged in different ways. So on this view, there literally are no chairs or tables or horses or people. They're just fundamental particles which may be arranged chair-wise or table-wise or people-wise and so on. So the reason that chairs and tables and people and other things never begin to exist is not that they have always existed, but rather because they never do exist. There literally are no such things. Unfortunately, in this case, the cure is worse than the disease. For now, the objector has to say that the reason he never began to exist is because he himself does not exist. Now, that might leave us wondering why we should bother responding to him, since there is nobody to respond to. Indeed, on this view, nobody has ever raised this objection. So why bother responding to it since it's never been brought up by anybody? In any case, I think it is absurd to deny one's own existence. I'm reminded of the story of the first year philosophy student who had been reading Descartes and one morning burst into his professor's office, bleary-eyed, unshaven. He had obviously been up all night. And he said to his professor, "Professor, tell me, do I exist?" And the professor looked at him and said, "Who wants to know?" It is simply absurd to deny one's own existence. In any case, all of these mental machinations, I think, are ultimately of no avail because we can simply reformulate the argument to meet the scruples of the Mereological nihilist. Here would be an example of how we could reformulate it. Premise one, if the fundamental particles arranged universe-wise began to exist, they have a cause. Two, the fundamental particles arranged universe-wise began to exist. Three, therefore, the fundamental particles arranged universe-wise have a cause. And now we're right back to where we were before. The serious point of this muddled objection, I think, is its assumption that everything that begins to exist must have a material cause. But that claim is simply irrelevant to the truth of the two premises of the Kalam cosmological argument. And it would require proof in any case. Now, it's true that in our experience, things do not begin to exist without material causes. So we have the same sort of inductive evidence on behalf of material causation that we have for efficient causation. But if we have good grounds and evidence that the material realm had an absolute beginning, which was not preceded by anything, this can override the inductive evidence for the universality of material causation. And I think that's exactly what we have. The point is that on the Kalam cosmological argument, we have good evidence to believe that space and time, matter and energy, have an absolute beginning. And therefore, they must have at least an efficient cause, even though there is no material cause. Notice, moreover, that if it is absurd for the universe to come into being without a material cause, it would be doubly absurd to say that it came into being with neither an efficient nor a material cause, because being doesn't come from non-being. But there's no metaphysical absurdity in saying that the universe has an efficient cause, even though it lacks a material cause. Objection number 7. The argument equivocates on the expression begins to exist. In premise 1, it means to begin from a previous material state, but in 2, it means not from a material state. Answer to number 7. In order to defeat the allegation of equivocation, all you have to do is provide a univocal meaning for the phrase in both of its occurrences. And that's easy to do. By begins to exist, I mean comes into being. Everything that comes into being has a cause, and the universe came into being. No equivocation here. Now, if we want to, we can go further and provide an analysis of what it means to begin to exist. Here is one such analysis. Let me see if I have a PowerPoint. Yes, I do. Begins to exist means that, X begins to exist if and only if X comes into being. Here's the analysis. X begins to exist if and only if X exists at some time T, and there is no time, T star, prior to T, at which X exists. And this analysis, I think, is adequate for all practical purposes. It would allow that even time itself began to exist. It would only become problematic in the case that one thinks that God is timeless without creation and enters time at the first moment of creation. In such a case, God would exist at the first moment of time, T0, and there would be no time, T star, earlier than T0 at which God existed. And therefore, it would follow from this analysis that God began to exist at T0, which is wrong-headed, because God didn't come into being at T0. Fortunately, we can fix this problem by simply amending our analysis slightly to read, X begins to exist if and only if X exists at some time T, and there is no time T star prior to T, at which X exists, and no state of affairs in the actual world in which X exists timelessly. So amended, the analysis does not imply that God began to exist at the first moment of time if he enters time from a state of timelessness at the moment of creation. So, in summary, the objections to the second premise are just as bad as the objections to the first. Now, the second premise is certainly controversial and very much open to debate, but not for the reasons that have been alleged here. Finally, objections to the argument's conclusion. Objection number 8. The argument is logically self-contradictory, for it says that everything has a cause, and yet it concludes that there is a first uncaused cause. Response to number 8. How do people come up with these objections? Premise 1 says that everything that begins to exist has a cause. Something cannot come into being without a cause. But this premise does not require that something that is eternal and never had a beginning has a cause. Think again of Plato and his distinction between that which always is and that which comes into being. The objector has simply been inattentive to the formulation of the first premise of the argument. Now notice that this is not special pleading for God. The atheist has typically said that the universe is eternal and therefore uncaused. Matter and energy have existed from eternity past and so have no cause of their being. The problem is that assumption has now been rendered dubious in light of the strong arguments in support of premise 2 that the universe began to exist. Objection number 9. The cause mentioned in the argument's conclusion is not different from nothing. For timelessness, changelessness, spacelessness, etc., are all purely negative attributions which are also true of nothingness. Thus, the argument might as well be taken to prove that the universe came into being from nothing. Response to number 9. You've got to be kidding. The argument concludes to a cause of the universe. That is a positive existential affirmation. There is a cause of the universe. To say that the universe was caused by nothing, by contrast, is to affirm that it was not caused by anything. Or in other words, that the universe is uncaused, which is the very opposite of the argument's conclusion. Moreover, the argument's conclusion also implies the attribution of incredible causal power to the entity that brought the universe into being without any sort of material cause. It is therefore wholly different from nothing, which has no reality, no properties, no causal powers. Finally, the attribution of negative predicates like timelessness, changelessness, spacelessness, and so on to this entity is enormously informative and metaphysically significant. From its timelessness and immateriality, I've argued that we can deduce its personhood. This is a property of great positive importance and utterly unlike nothingness. Finally, objection number 10. Our final objection comes courtesy of that enfant terrible of the new atheism, Richard Dawkins. Dawkins doesn't refute either premise of the Kalam cosmological argument. Instead, he just complains about the argument's conclusion. He says, even if we allow the dubious luxury of arbitrarily conjuring up a terminator to an infinite regress and giving it a name, there is absolutely no reason to endow that terminator with any of the properties normally ascribed to God. Omnipotence, omniscience, goodness, creativity of design. To say nothing of human attributes such as listening to prayers, forgiving sins, and reading innermost thoughts. Response to number 10. apart from the opening dig, this is an amazingly concessionary statement. Dawkins doesn't deny that the argument successfully demonstrates the existence of an uncaused, beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and unimaginably powerful personal creator of the universe. He merely complains that this creator hasn't also been shown to be omnipotent, omniscient, good, creative of design, listening to prayers, forgiving sins, and reading innermost thoughts. To which I say, so what? The argument wasn't intended to prove those things. It would be a bizarre form of atheism, indeed an atheism not worth the name, that conceded that there exists an uncaused, beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and unimaginably powerful personal creator of the universe, who may, for all we know, also have the properties listed by Dawkins. Now, we don't need to call this personal creator God if Dawkins finds that objectionable or misleading, but the point remains that such a being, as described in the argument, must exist. So, in conclusion, there you have it, the world's 10 worst objections to the cosmological argument. These represent the level of discourse that pervades the internet and YouTube. And I hope you can see how worthless they are. I hope you don't feel that I've wasted your time, because in discussing these bad arguments, I hope you've gained a better understanding of the sort of fallacies that are often alleged against the argument and some deeper insight into the argument itself. I think we have time now for discussion. Thank you. The question was, if God were shown to be logically incoherent, would that sweep God off the table? Right. If God is literally logically incoherent, then there couldn't be any such being. Yes?
Can I come back to objection number one?
Yes.
It's this objection where you get attacked for being a hypocrite.
Yes.
And your answer was that your faith doesn't depend on this argument. But I think the next question would be, so what's the argument supposed to do then? Why are you presenting this argument?
That's not an objection to the argument. My response to the objection was that the worth of the argument is independent of my psychological state.
Yes.
And that, I think, is absolutely correct. My psychological state has absolutely nothing to do with the soundness of this argument. Now, your question, therefore, really isn't about the argument. You're just asking, I guess, why do I bother spending my time with this sort of thing? And I guess I would say because I think that the Holy Spirit can use this argument to draw people to himself by showing them that there's good evidence for belief in God, and it's perfectly rational to believe in God. In my own religious epistemology, I distinguish between how I know that Christianity is true and how I show Christianity is true. I know Christianity is true fundamentally through the inner witness of the Holy Spirit, but I show someone else that it is true by presenting arguments and evidence in support of Christian truth claims. And so I'm interested in that latter task. Yes?
I'm probably just showing my ignorance. Could you just unpack how this argument shows
right. I didn't go into that. I think in view of our limited time, I just refer you to my published work on this, Reasonable Faith or On Guard, because that really isn't germane to the topic this morning. But I give there, I think, three arguments as to why I think it's plausibly a personal being. Yes.
Scholars around the world that call themselves atheists, how do they explain the existence of the universe? What is their argument?
Well, they'll either deny the second premise and simply say that the universe is eternal and uncaused, or, remarkably, in our day and age, faced with the strong evidence for the beginning of the universe, quite a number of atheists bite the bullet and say the universe just popped into being without a cause. That it just... One of my colleagues, Quentin Smith, put it so well. He said the most rational position to hold is that the universe came by nothing, from nothing, and for nothing.
The cause of the universe is not personal. How would you react to that?
Well, I would have to hear the argument. What is the argument that the cause of the universe is not personal?
Is that from the fact that the universe began to exist, it doesn't mean that there must be cause which has a personal effect.
Right. I agree with that. The personhood of the first cause only emerges when you do a conceptual analysis of what it is to be a cause of the universe. So there are three independent arguments that I give for the personhood of the first cause. And I'll just simply refer you to my published work to talk about those or to look at those. Yes?
In this objection number four, which deals with the question why everything that begins to exist has a cause. One of the sentence number three says, common experience and scientific evidence confirm the truth of premise number one. But we're dealing here with things that everybody knows, and everybody knows that in quantum physics, there are things which are not caused. Particles just pop into existence. So how do you respond in a lecture?
I respond in two ways. First, I will say that it is not, in fact, known scientifically that virtual particles pop into being uncaused. There are at least 10 different physical interpretations of the equations of quantum mechanics. And some of these, like David Bohm's quantum mechanics, are thoroughly deterministic. Everything is causally determined. And nobody knows which one of these 10, if any, is the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics. So it is simply not true that quantum mechanics demonstrates that indeterminacy is a feature of reality, is ontic, rather than simply epistemic in our minds. Secondly, even if these virtual particles come spontaneously into being as fluctuations of the energy in the vacuum, they don't come into being from nothing. The quantum vacuum is decidedly not nothing. And those scientists who have used the word nothing to represent the quantum vacuum are guilty of a misrepresentation of science so serious that I think it's a deliberate abuse of science. If a religious believer were so seriously to misrepresent a scientific theory, he would be denounced for deliberate distortion of science. In quantum mechanics, the quantum vacuum is space filled with a sea of roiling energy, described by quantum field equations having a rich physical structure. It is not, in any sense, nothing. So it isn't true that these particles come into being from nothing, even on an indeterministic physical interpretation. They're produced or caused by the quantum vacuum.
But this would be the material cause, not the efficient cause.
Well, I think it would also be the efficient cause. pardon me. I'm fighting a cold, as you can tell. The quantum mechanical vacuum is, I think, the efficient cause of these particles as well. It's what produces them in being. In fact, in one sense, this is almost an example of efficient causation without material causation, because the energy in the vacuum isn't reduced as a result of these fluctuations, as a result of these particles. It's not as though when these particles fluctuate into being, the energy in the vacuum goes down. There's just a certain indeterminacy that allows them to exist for a brief moment, and then they go back into the vacuum again. So it's far from evident that they have any material cause, really, on this indeterministic interpretation. But I would say that the quantum vacuum itself serves as a kind of efficient cause that generates these particles through fluctuating activity? Good question. Yes?
I've heard it said that, you know, whatever happened at the beginning of the universe, whatever it was that happened when it wasn't something that applies, you know, we can apply kind of intuitions to. I think Dennett made that argument. This is sort of, you know, whatever happened, it was remarkable, it was odd, and so therefore to sort of say, to kind of apply, you know, common observations about causality and so on, you know, may not be legitimate in that area.
Yeah. I think that's clearly just hand-waving. That's just an attempt to elude the force of the argument. What Dennett actually says in his written work is that the universe caused itself to come into being. He says it's the ultimate bootstrapping trick. It's brought itself into existence, which is metaphysically absurd, because to bring itself into being, it would have to exist prior to itself, which is logically incoherent. So there's nothing about these metaphysical principles like that out of nothing, nothing comes, or something cannot come into being out of nothing, that would be called into question by the Big Bang theory or other theories of the origin of the universe. Indeed, to deny these would be to subvert science, because the whole quest of modern cosmogony is to give an account of the origin of the universe and to look for causes of it, to explain why the universe is as it is. And so this would really be subversive of science to adopt this sort of attitude, I think. Yes?
Do you believe in the intelligence of life in the universe except on our planet?
Do I?
Yeah.
I'm agnostic about whether there's intelligent life elsewhere in the cosmos. I don't know. Yes?
I'm sorry for asking another question.
It's all right.
I think the way out of all of this argumentation would be, in a normal conversation, for people to say, well, then the universe didn't begin to exist. You know, there are multiverses and
yes.
multiple crunches and all of this
right.
thing. What do you respond to that?
If the philosophical arguments are sound, they will apply to previous cycles of the universe, multiverses, and so forth. If the philosophical arguments against an infinite regress are sound, they are unaffected by these sorts of hypotheses. Secondly, even on a scientific level, no one has managed to formulate a model of the universe which can be extrapolated to past infinity and avoids the beginning of the universe. Cyclical models, eternal inflationary models, metastable quantum states, all of these have been tried and failed to extrapolate to past infinity. Alexander Vilenkin, one of the most famous living cosmologists, just presented a paper in January at Cambridge at a conference celebrating the 70th birthday of Stephen Hawking. And Vilenkin examined three attempts to avoid the beginning of the universe through eternal inflation, cyclical prior cycles of the universe, and what he calls his cosmic egg hypothesis of an initial meta-stable state. And he showed that none of them can avoid the beginning of the universe. And he summed it up by saying, all the evidence we have says that the universe began to exist. Now, that's a remarkable statement when you think about it. He wasn't saying the evidence for a beginning outweighs the evidence against a beginning. No, he didn't say that. He said all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. So I'm not aware of anything on the other side of the scale. Scientific evidence is always tentative and provisional, but as far as I know, there is no evidence that the universe is beginningless. All of the evidence, as Vilenkin says that the universe began to exist, including cyclical models, cosmic egg, eternal inflation, all these other attempts. If you're interested in these, take a look at the article that I co-wrote with the physicist Jim Sinclair in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, where Jim surveys a wide range of contemporary models and shows how they don't avoid the beginning. In fact, I'm going to be talking about that here at this conference in the Scientific Network tomorrow, I think, where I'll be surveying these scientific models and the evidence for a beginning of the universe. So it's really quite extraordinary that science should uncover this kind of evidence. I shake my head in wonder that this could be happening, and yet it is. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, do you happen to know the citation for the Leventhal
article? Yes, it's in the New Scientist magazine, an article by Lisa somebody on this conference. I think it's January 11th, 2012, New Scientist. The paper that Vilenkin read at that conference has just been published in April, just last month. It's called Did the Universe Have a Beginning? It's co-authored with, I think, one of his graduate students named Mathani. And that just came out on the Archief website for cosmology. So that has just appeared. All right, well, thank you very much for your attention.